Item one, the jobs report was honestly great. Item two, the stock market is not the economy. Item three, and not unrelated, oh, by the way, Tuesday is Election Day. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the second day of November 2018. Good as always to have you along, everybody. 250,000, a quarter million new jobs in this economy last month. More people coming into the labor force as well. So the unemployment rate stayed where it was, 3.7%. A quite nifty report, to be honest. So that's where we'll start our review of the past 5 days in this economy. Lee Gallagher's at Fortune Magazine. John Harwood is with CNBC. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lee, with the caveat that we're going to have Mitchell Hartman coming up here in a minute to talk about the wages part of this report, what else did you like? What's not to like? I mean, it was pretty good.
It was pretty good across the board. As you said, 250,000 jobs. The rate holds steady at 3.7%. It's still at this 49-year low. Participation was strong. Mm-hmm. The big star, which Mitchell will talk to, is the wage figure, which was up 3.1%. So, and this really shows that the economy is still strengthening, the jobs outlook in particular, a decade into this expansion that is already very, very far along.
John, that's what I was going to say. We're getting long in the tooth for adding a quarter million new jobs.
That's right, and that's to be applauded. However, the strength of the report also underscores the fact that we don't necessarily need deficit finance stimulus mm-hmm. in this economy, and when the economy ends up slowing down, as it's expected to do certainly by 2020, then if we have a downturn, we're going to have less fiscal flexibility to respond.
Which we should say a lot of people are predicting in 2020-21, and we're going to get there in a minute. I want to turn now, though, John, to the president and the state of this economy and some of the things he's saying as we enter the home stretch before Election Day. Yesterday, the president said he's got a deal with China and everything's going fine. He didn't say he's got a deal. He said everything's going fine. We really want to make a deal. Everything is good. And the stock market sort of bounced off its lows for the day and reacted. This morning, Larry Kudlow, the president's chief economic advisor, said this.
There's no mass movement. There's no huge thing. We're not on the cusp of a deal. As the president said, you know, we'd like to talk to them about it, but they may not be ready. I mean, that's been the unsatisfactory response from China.
The market reacted appropriately, which is to say, oh, well, if we don't have a trade deal, maybe things are bad. And so selling began. And then the president literally 2 hours later came out and said this.
President Xi and I have agreed to meet at the G20. We'll be having dinner. We'll be discussing it. But I think a very good deal will be made with China. They want to make it very badly. We want to make a deal if we can. And a lot of progress has been made.
So that's a long windup, John, into a really cynical question, which is the president juicing the stock market 5 days before the election?
Yes. The president, even though the stock market is not the economy, as you like to point out, President Trump considers it a report card on his economy, and he is pushing every button he has for the midterm election. And he saw the market ending this week on a down note, and he wanted to goose it a little bit. We've long since learned that the things President Trump says moment to moment usually don't outlive those moments. Mm-hmm. And so I would trust Larry Kudlow as somewhat more firmly grounded in reality on this topic.
Lee, let me ask you what's going to make me – it's a question that's going to make me sound silly. It honestly is, but I think it needs to be out there.
You never sound silly, Kai.
I often do, but that's a whole different thing. help me understand why, with unemployment where it is, historically low, jobs where they are, which is going great guns, the economy growing, consumer confidence and spending high, why are Republicans not running on the economy?
It's interesting. You really don't hear it. You hear a lot of other things. And I think one of the reasons is that, again, the economy and the stock market are not the same thing. There are still a lot of people who are not participating and not feeling the benefits of all of this. And even things like the job climate and the job outlook are very regional. And you still have a lot of people who are impacted, by the way, by these the tariffs mm-hmm. and the threat of a trade war. You've got farmers, you've got people in the auto industry. And those people might also respond to the comments about there being a deal soon and when they go to the polls on Tuesday. So I think that's a big part of it. But I don't I don't really know. There's also a theory that voters' minds are fixed when it comes to the economy as far as 6 months before an election. So that could be playing a role, but it certainly is a bright spot.
John, give me go ahead. Give me the inside the beltway gimlet eye on this one.
Well, I think it has an awful lot to do with the long trend toward income inequality in the country. It's much more difficult than it was, say, when Ronald Reagan ran a Morning in America campaign in 1984 to run on a broad message of prosperity. There's a bifurcated Republican message. They are emphasizing the economy to their donors who finance their campaigns, but to their voters, many of whom don't even know they got a tax cut because it was so small, they're doing cultural messages. And with President Trump throwing in the impromptu, you're going to get a 10% tax cut a few days before the election, even though there is no such tax cut.
So let me bring it back then to the Fed and to what happens now with this jobs report and a thing that's on the president's mind, because he says it all the time, that the Fed is raising interest rates and they're the president's biggest enemy. With this jobs report, there's no doubt that they're going to keep raising, right, Lee? And thus the president will be ever more annoyed with the Fed.
Yes, this all but confirms that the Fed will stay the course to raise rates and gradually lift rates next year. I mean, the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, said that he thinks that the economy can grow for the next 2 years, you know, with, I forget the words he used, effectively indefinitely. So he's very confident on the economy. And I think this is what happens. This is what happens when things go well.
John Harwood, 30 seconds. Last thought to you on that question.
Well, I think there's also a credibility issue for Jay Powell, even apart from this report, because the president's made so much noise about him being displeased with the Fed for raising rates, never mind the fact that he, during the Obama administration, he said they should raise rates. I think Powell, for both substantive reasons and the reasons of the credibility of the Fed, will stay on the same path that he's on.
What was interesting was Kudlow yesterday said, no, the president hasn't called Jay Powell to talk about interest rates yet. So there you go. John Harwood at CNBC, also the New York Times sometimes, and Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you two.
Thanks,
you
Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, well, we kind of went over that. Traders were whipsawed by, well, politics. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we did the very quick headlines of the jobs report, Lee and John and I, but that 3.1% year-over-year increase in average hourly earnings does merit a little bit more time because it is the fastest that wages have grown in this economy in 9.5 years. Not a huge surprise, right? Unemployment is crazy low. Companies are complaining to anybody who will listen about how hard it is to find qualified workers, and tight labor markets can lead to higher wages. But you know what higher wages can lead to? Higher prices. And you know who might have something to say about that? Well, the Fed. That's who. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, as promised, has that one.
Anything that raises employers' costs to make things or provide services can push up the prices they charge consumers. For instance, higher fuel prices, or tariffs, or workers' wages. And Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute says today's jobs report shows that employers are grappling with higher labor costs.
Starting to finally see the flywheel engage for wage increases. I've been surprised, like everyone else, that it's taken such a low unemployment rate to get there.
Now, keep in mind, the Federal Reserve has a dual mandate to keep unemployment low and inflation in check. The Fed has already raised interest rates 3 times this year, in part to prevent inflation from getting out of hand as the economy runs hot. Gary Hoover at the University of Oklahoma worries that rising wages could lead the Fed to raise rates higher sooner.
Why be so quick to hit the button to cool things down? That's not necessarily appropriate at this point, given this is more catching up as opposed to surging ahead.
But there are pitfalls if the Fed waits too long to act, says Samir Samana at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
You risk letting the inflation genie out of the bottle, in which case then we need rate hikes at a much faster pace.
Which would likely slow the job market and squelch wage gains before workers have caught up after years of mediocre raises. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It is a fact of labor economics that you can't talk about the job market without eventually talking about immigration. Not the politics of it in this country right now, but the actual economics. Amy Scott did a story yesterday about how long-term economic growth relies on two things, a more productive labor force and a growing labor force. The reality is that without immigrants, the American labor force would barely be growing at all. Told you that so we could tell you this. Bloomberg News got a hold of a letter Fed Chair Jay Powell, who is, by the way, making an unexpectedly large appearance in the program today. He wrote a letter back in August. It was a response to a question from a Democratic senator asking for Powell's thoughts on the effects of immigration on economic growth. Here's Amy with what Powell said.
In his letter, according to Bloomberg, Powell said, quote, from an economic growth standpoint, reduced immigration would result in lower population growth and thus, all else equal, slower trend economic growth, end quote. Economist Aparna Mathur with the American Enterprise Institute says there's a common perception that the U.S. is doing immigrants a big favor by letting them come in.
But we have to recognize that immigrants make important economic contributions.
Mathur herself came to the U.S. from India on an H-1B visa. Former Fed economist Madeline Zavadny, now at the University of North Florida, says it's simple math.
Over the last decade, immigrants, legal and illegal, accounted for about half of labor force growth in the United States.
And their U.S.-born children accounted for another sixth of that growth. But get this, looking at projections for the next decade and the one after that,
all of the labor force growth will come from immigrants and their children.
That's because, yes, the baby boomers are aging out of the workforce and Americans are having fewer kids. Even with immigration, economist Carrie Leahy says the labor force is only growing at about 1% a year.
And in the U.S., where labor force growth is about as slow as it's been in the last 50 years, anything that could boost the growth rate from 1% to even 1.25% would be welcome.
Because, again, the faster the labor force grows, the faster the economy can grow. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A story now from the Everything is a Business Opportunity file. As we told you last month, Sears has filed for bankruptcy protection. It's going to close 150 or so Sears and Kmart stores across the country. And a lot of those stores are holding giant closeout sales, which is sad news for the 125-year-old retailer, but good news for those in the professional liquidation trade. Marketplace's Renata Sago takes us to Tampa, Florida for a look at the business of closing a business.
The Sears store at University Mall in Tampa looks sort of like a garage sale, except with brand new products. Items are stacked on shelves in no particular order. Others are scattered across the sales floor with brightly colored handwritten price tags. Signs everywhere command, everything must go. Elliptical machines, 50% off. Tools, 30% off. Display cases for jewelry, sold. Sidney Mondesir stopped in as soon as he heard about the store closing.
I came for a toaster I saw earlier, but hey, it's gone.
He makes a slow stroll from appliances through nearly every section of the store, including men's clothes, where he finds something else he wants, a nice shirt.
I don't know how much they're going to give me this one. If it's not $3, I'm going to leave it.
Before discounted merchandise ends up in the hands of Mondesir and other shoppers, plans for store liquidations must go through a careful process, says Anthony Chikumba, managing director of Loop Capital Markets. In the case of a company like Sears going through Chapter 11 restructuring, they must be approved by three parties: the company's creditors, a federal bankruptcy court, and a third party that's appointed to squeeze as much money from the bankrupt company's assets as possible. That company for Sears is Abacus Advisors Group. It wouldn't comment for this story, but Chikumba says typically a restructuring firm tries to
figure out, you know, what combination of keeping stores open, liquidating stores, selling assets will maximize value for the debt holders at this point.
It's a legal process that can take months. Sears is about $5 billion in debt. To offset that, Chikumba says, merchandise sales are just the beginning. The brand itself could be sold off, as well as its real estate. It's all about answering the main question on creditors' minds.
Well, how am I going to get the most pennies on the dollar?
Sometimes that means bringing in merchandise liquidators like David Solomon, who runs the company Closeouts World in Fort Lauderdale. He says he's worked with Sears stores in the past, but isn't right now.
I've seen chain stores go out of business where the owners, the CEOs, have just been sitting and crying while their stores were being dismantled piece by piece.
Solomon says stores going out of business or restructuring firms will contact him and say, we've got a certain amount of merchandise worth X amount, and either A, would you like to bid on it?
Or B, would you like to take the price that we're interested in and maybe give us somehow of an understanding of, you know, are you going to be able to work with that price? Do you need to be a little bit lower?
Solomon's the middleman between one store that's getting rid of merchandise and another in need of it. He buys in bulk at a discount and tries to sell items for more. His customers include other retailers, flea markets, even stores abroad. A lot of what he buys transits through here.
So this is our warehouse.
At any given moment, his warehouse is filled with pallets of all kinds of things, from designer jeans and shoes to plastic swords.
Here's a pallet of toys. You open this one up, little dinosaurs, little car sets.
He says he and other liquidators can make anywhere from 2 to 15%, depending on the product and volume.
The more merchandise that we buy, the better prices we get, and the better prices our customers get as well.
The Sears store in liquidation has $6 million in merchandise, according to a store manager who wasn't authorized to talk. Sears declined to be interviewed, but in a statement said it would continue to honor warranties for products sold at its liquidation sales. In Fort Lauderdale, I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Coming up,
do what works for you. Now, not do anything you want, but like do what actually adds value to your life.
How to bite the bullet journal. That is, first though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 109 points today, 0.4%, 25,270. The NASDAQ down 77 points, 1%, 7356. The S&P 500 off 17 points, 0.6%, 27.23. For the week, the Dow up 2.3%. The NASDAQ picked up 2.6%. The S&P 500 advanced 2.4%. Apple tanked 6.6% today after investors got a chance to fully digest yesterday's after-the-bell earnings report. Not so good is the TLDR. Starbucks steamed ahead 9.7% today. It beat Street estimates on quarterly profits. Same-store sales were up 3% higher than the consensus estimate. They got 4.50 from me today, for whatever that's worth. Yield on the 10-year T-note, let me just slide this in, up 3.22%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Listen, I want you to subscribe to a podcast I do with Molly Wood. It's called Make Me Smart. Every week, we connect the dots on all things technology, economy, and culture. And with the midterm elections coming up next week, we talked about the thing that we love to hate, or at least, well, I do, kind of, polling, how it's simple and not so simple all at the same time.
There are really only two problems to solve. Who are you going to ask, and what are you going to ask them? But within each of those things, there are a million decisions that you have to make.
Make Me Smart. Get us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is news from the Internal Revenue Service that will be of interest to those in this economy who are able to put aside money for retirement. The IRS has just increased, for the first time in years, actually, how much you can contribute to your retirement accounts. If you've got what's called an individual retirement account, an IRA, you can now contribute up to $6,000 a year. That's a $500 increase. For 401ks or 403bs, it's now $19,000, also a $500 bump. But the problem is that a whole lot of people in this economy, most actually, don't or can't take full advantage of those savings plans. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
When Riley Adams was in his early 20s, his parents gave him some financial advice. Save as much as you can for retirement and start now.
They just saw what could have been. They could have retired earlier if they had contributed sooner.
So Adams, who lives in New Orleans, set a goal to reach the legal limit for retirement account contributions. At 29, with a steady job at the local power company, he's finally done it. It takes some sacrifices. He and his wife live in a small apartment. They don't dine out a lot.
My wife and I are both driving cars that are by no means bad, but they're almost a decade old.
Vanguard estimates that only 13% of people with employer-sponsored retirement plans put in the max amount every year. Jason Estelle is a financial advisor at Edward Jones, and he says getting clients, especially young ones, to max out their contributions, it's a hard sell.
They feel more comfortable having cash in their bank account. They've seen the markets go up and down. They're not comfortable about how the market works, and that's really the biggest issue.
Other people don't max out their contributions because they can't afford it. And Monique Morrissey at the Economic Policy Institute says it's okay if you can't contribute the max.
The real problem isn't that most people aren't contributing the maximum, but is that most people are not contributing anything at all or a very small amount each year.
The other lesson from financial advisors, it's never too late to start. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
You got your lists, of course, that set of things you got to get done. Then you've got your planners and your day books, slightly more ambitious lists, right? Now you've got something called a bullet journal. It's a diary and a planner and a sketch pad all in one, a life hack, really, kind of gone viral. Ryder Carroll is the guy who invented the bullet journal method and who has now written a book about it called The Bullet Journal Method. Ryder, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So for those who are unfamiliar with this, as full disclosure, I was until I heard a couple of producers around here talking about it. What is the bullet journal method?
I think the short version is that the bullet journal method is a mindfulness practice that's disguised as a productivity system that uses nothing more than a notebook and a pen.
Well, so how is it different than like from one of those planner day books that I can get it right in?
Sure. So I would think of the bullet journal method more as an idea that is implemented through pen and paper, very free form, and it's modular, and people plug in their own tools, if you will, ones that they design.
Tools being what? Ideas and thoughts and graphics? And I mean, you've got a pretty good explainer video that basically says, design this thing the way it works for you.
Yeah, so basically what I try to do with the tutorial is lay the foundation. So when I say tools, maybe we're talking about a project or a health tracker or a gym tracker. It could be whatever the user needs and getting into a habit of consistently prioritizing.
Where did you get this idea? How did it happen?
It took a lifetime to develop, essentially, but it was born through a need. When I was young, I was diagnosed with ADD, and back then there weren't a lot of tools available to me, so I started creating my own tools that helped me tackle my challenges with focus and productivity and organization. And over the decades, essentially, I started developing these small tools and techniques, and the only real platform that I had available as a kid, which was a notebook. And I started to figure out ways to organize myself that worked the way that my mind worked. And over the years, I refined those techniques over and over and over again until they eventually became what is the bullet journal today.
We are, though, in an internet age, right, and a digital age. And here you're saying, in essence, you can gain some degree of emotional control over a chaotic and busy life with pen and paper.
Yeah, so don't get me wrong. I think that technology is incredibly valuable. Like, technology has allowed us to connect with the world around us in ways that we never imagined before. But I feel like the more connected we get with the world around us, the less connected we are with the world within us. Our lives have turned into an always online, always available existence. And in that, we don't really have an opportunity to think anymore. So for me, taking a step back and sitting down with my notebook automatically disconnects me. And then all of a sudden, really interesting things happen when I just stop and think.
We have a producer here who is the one who said, listen, we should do this interview. And she keeps a bullet journal, and it's individualized, it's artistic, it's detailed. And I wonder if part of the reason this might work so well for so many people is that you do allow that individualization and people are encouraged to be creative with how they do this.
Very much so. So what I always try to tell people when they get into bullet journaling, do what works for you. Yeah. Now, not do anything you want, but like do what actually adds value to your life. And everybody has very unique needs and priorities. And that's really exciting to see because all of these things are choices based on their lived experience. You know, for those who are more creative, they're like, this is one place in my life where I can just do whatever I want to do. You know, like I can be creative, I can illustrate my books, and for other people, it's just a way for them to clarify their thoughts very quickly in a way they hadn't before.
Ryder Carroll, the book and the method, I suppose, is called The Bullet Journal Method. Ryder, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on.
This is one of those where the visuals are really going to help the audio. Our digital team has made part of our website look like a page from a bullet journal. You can check it out, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which in a way makes sense, but about which in a way you're also like, really, Jeff? Jeff here being Jeff Bezos, the grand poobah at Amazon, which is, as you might have heard, scouting around for a second headquarters location. HQ2 is the lingo. Anyway, at a conference in New York today, Bezos said this about the decision that 20 American cities are betting a whole lot of their economic futures on, quote, "The best way to make it is you collect as much data as you can. You immerse yourself in that data, but then you make that decision with your heart," end quote. In my heart, after reviewing all of the data, Amazon Prime is free. All right, we got to go. The first Friday in November is in the books. Dow Industrials off 109 today, 0.4%. NASDAQ down 77%. S&P 500 dropped 17 points, about 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.